on Saturday, November 5th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall of the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. More information is available at 333-6280.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin this second hour of the show. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Maybe just before we get going in this hour, I do want to mention a couple of programming changes, just to keep up to date with what we're doing here today on AM 580. At 1 o'clock this afternoon, the National Public Radio will be offering a new special dealing with President Bush's nomination of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was just announced this morning. So there will be a conversation here hosted by Neil Conan. We'll include a number of different guests, political commentators on the right and the left, reporters. Mara Liasson will be there from NPR's Washington desk, and some other guests too. So that will take the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine special program looking at President Bush's nomination of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. Then later on this afternoon, we will air the Capitol Steps Halloween program that we had originally scheduled for the 1 o'clock hour this afternoon. We'll bump that into 3:30. So if you're interested in having a little political humor, you can tune in there for Cap Steps at 3:30, and then more on the Supreme Court nomination in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine this afternoon. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about literacy. And one of what some people, I'm sure, would say is one of the most difficult issues in education today. And that is the racial achievement gap in literacy. And nowhere is that gap more troubling than in the case of young black men. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with Alfred Tatum. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Literacy Education at Northern Illinois University. And this is a particular interest of his in his research and in his work as a teacher, adolescent literacy, and specifically literacy development of African American males. We'll be talking about some of what you will find in a book that he's written on the subject, which is titled Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males, Closing the Achievement Gap. Stenhouse is the publisher on this book. It's really a book intended for teachers, but certainly it's an issue that concerns an awful lot of people. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Before joining the faculty at NIU, he was assistant professor of reading in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction at University of Maryland, and he began his career as an eighth grade teacher on the South Side of Chicago, where he taught for 5 years. He's going to be here in Champaign-Urbana coming up this weekend, next Saturday. He will be giving a talk on this very subject, about the subject that is the basis for his book and for a lot of his work, Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males. And this is a program that's sponsored by a number of organizations here in our area, including the Illini Reading Council, the Champaign-Ford Regional Office of Education, Champaign and Urbana Schools, the U of I College of Education, and the Urbana Free Library. And I hope I have not left anyone out. It's all taking place at the Urbana Free Library on Saturday from 10 until noon. And I believe that it's open to the public, and anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And as we talk here this morning on the program, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, people are certainly welcome to call. Professor Tatum, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We certainly appreciate it. To do the numbers a little bit here, it seems that if you take a look at literacy performance, among the things we know is that girls do better than boys, and that poor kids do less well than kids who are not poor, and there are certainly some ethnic groups, African American kids among them, who are disadvantaged. It looks like if you look at who's going to be the most at risk. For the most factors, it does come down to this group that we're talking about here that you're particularly interested in, and that's a young black man.
That is correct.
Can you put some more numbers on that?
Well, when you look at the data that comes from the National Assessment of Education Progress, it usually indicates that African-American males at the eighth grade are performing just as well as white males at the fourth grade level. And then when you look at African-American males at the 12th grade level, their performance is somewhat comparable to white males at the eighth grade level. So in that sense, there is a significant lag that should raise our ire, particularly as it relates to young African-American males.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you note in the book is that certainly now for some time, and that we're talking about decades now, the achievement gap between white students and black students has been something people have known about.
Yes.
And talked about. And in fact, strategies have been applied. And one can say that perhaps some progress, maybe not what we would like, but some progress has been made. Having said all that, though, the gap still does exist. And I'm really struck by the fact that you note in the book among the barriers that stand in the way of closing the gap even further is that there's no clear strategy on how to get to where it is we want to go, which makes you wonder, you know, how it is that we could be talking about this now for decades, having a lot of attention focused on the problem, and at the same time we would say, but we're still not really sure how to approach it.
Yes, I mean that's part of the problem. In many ways, we've tried to address the problems from what I refer to as an anatomically incomplete model, using reading skills and strategies alone to address the literacy needs of African American males. But we haven't been clear about what we're trying to accomplish with these skills and strategies. So what you will have, as more skills and strategies have been applied, there has been a marginal increase. But in terms of substantial gains, there are, you know, several pieces that's missing. When we have to really look at the role of curriculum and the role of text in these young men's lives, and also providing the professional development support that will allow teachers to apply the skill and strategy knowledge that has developed over the past 25 years in more robust ways to address some of the dilemmas that African-American males are facing outside of school. And if we have a limited approach that just focuses on skills and strategies, I suspect that the reading achievement gap will remain steadfast for quite a long time.
Mm. I think that's an interesting point, and I'm sure that one we'll be spending some more time on, and that is that there has been so much emphasis on the skills part of this, and while that indeed might work, or at least work some in younger children, mm-hmm. that in fact, as far as you're talking about any child, if you have children, and we're talking about adolescents who are having difficulty reading or perhaps reluctant readers, mm-hmm. that we don't seem, in fact, it doesn't matter what kind of child you're talking about, it seems that we don't, it's not something that we really understand very well or have concrete approaches for it, as I say, at least not the way we do when you're talking about younger children.
Yes. Well, again, when we look at the developmental stage of adolescence, there are other variables involved, particularly this notion of identity development, and there are emerging social and cultural literacies that need to be paid attention to. So you may have students resisting during adolescence or sharing or displaying a different type of resistance during adolescence that's not shown with younger children. And by the time many of these struggling readers become adolescents, they have accumulated a failure over periods of time. So you cannot just say that we can teach you or use skills and strategies to rectify these problems if you have this accumulated failure that's becoming a roadblock and a barrier. In that way, they become distrustful of the value of these skills and strategies, because some of these students have never read with ease, although they've been inundated with a skill and strategy approach.
Mm-hmm. There, this gets at what I think is a really essential kind of point, and that is that with the argument that you're making, particularly with these students, and it may also be true of students when you get at the middle school and high school levels, maybe even more than younger kids, is that you have to consider what the purpose of reading is, mm-hmm. Whether it is it just sort of a mechanical act? Is it a set of skills? Or are we not paying enough attention to what it is we hope that the students will get out of the text? That is, we just don't pick things by accident, or perhaps sometimes we do, and that the what it is we're hoping that they'll get from the material, maybe we don't consider that as much as we should.
I would agree with that a great deal. There's ample historical precedence of how text has played a significant role in the lives of all students, but particularly African American males, in terms of shaping their identity or nurturing resilience or helping them develop a sense of manhood. Sometimes these types of texts are neglected if the focus is on if there's a psychometric focus to improve test scores, but I would be very cautious to separate the role of text and the mechanical process of reading. The challenge is finding the balance between the two of those. Oftentimes, we pay attention to more of the mechanical stuff, and we ignore the other literacy needs that need to be addressed as well. But there's a delicate balance that we need to strike.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Alfred Tatum. He's professor in the Department of Literacy Education at Northern Illinois University and is particularly interested in adolescent literacy and literacy development of African-American males. He's the author of the book Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males, Closing the Achievement Gap. And he will be giving a talk on this subject this coming weekend, that is Saturday, 5th of November, at the Urbana Free Library. And again, it's an event that is jointly sponsored by a lot of people who are interested in education here in our area: the Illini Reading Council, Champaign-Urbana Schools, the College of Education, the Free Library in Urbana. And anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. That's Saturday morning at 10 at the Urbana Free Library. We do have some callers here. You want to get into the conversation, so we'll do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. First caller is in Chicago on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. As an African-American, my antenna always goes up when the government announces or the news media announce statistics, and they only give them for Black and Hispanics and not for whites. On Friday, they announced that 50% of African-American children don't graduate from high school and 50% of Hispanic children don't graduate from high school, and there was no statistic for white American children. The second point I want to make, besides this, which happens all the time, the fact that we're never given statistics for white children, is that even helpful, given that today the average CEO makes 500 times more than his lowest paid worker? What can a social construct such as race tell you if you're not looking at economics? And we know that the different benefits that would help someone in reading are going to be affected by economics. So if we continue to just use these groups of what African-American children or young men are able to achieve, and we're not looking across the board at economic differences and how this factors into what children have access to, will we ever be able to solve any educational problem?
I would like to respond to that. I appreciate the caller's responses because I'm often concerned about the explosion of statistics or the litany of statistics that are given for African-American males and African-Americans in general and Latinos. The real danger in the statistics is that it posits white students as the measure of superiority in many ways. Usually when we use these statistics, they're comparing the white students who have achieved a level of mediocrity, but it doesn't come out that way. So the real achievement gap is between low performing students and high performing students. But there are some racial overtones when we compare between blacks and whites. But there's only one statistic that really matters that I often use in my presentations. I don't care if the students are African American, Latino, or white. There's one student in each of our classrooms who are trying to figure out what to do with their rest of their lives. And in that way, literacy becomes a form of activism. But we also have to be careful when we look at the economic differences. I think high students from a high economic status do have some advantages, but it doesn't necessarily mean that students from low economic backgrounds are at a disadvantage if they receive quality literacy instruction, and literacy is viewed as a form of activism and not something that's guided by a statistical framework in order to close this achievement gap that's out there. So we really have to look at these issues in more complex ways, and I think that's what the caller is begging for with her response and question.
Yes, I am. I'm particularly interested in the fact that economic differences do matter, and that if a child of a white family mm-hmm. is from a low-income family where there's no parent who has a higher level of education, mm-hmm. you're going to see a lot of the same results that you see for an African-American or Hispanic child in the same economic situation, because of the fact that having a parent who has gone through the educational system means that you have a mentor who will guide you over the humps and bumps and know where to get help from. And what happens with children in low economic status, you're right, the money wouldn't matter if the knowledge was there. But unfortunately, the knowledge about how the system works often is attached to the fact that you've had enough money to go through the system once.
I think that's true, but at the same time, we have to be careful, because we have some African American students, particularly in the state of Maryland. There was a study in the suburban state of in the suburbs of the state of Maryland, where there was economic parity between African Americans and whites, but the performance wasn't still equal. So there are other factors, although economics is essential, but we cannot allow that. The argument that I make, we cannot allow that to limit what teachers think is possible in the absence of economic advantage or high parental support. We have to be very careful not to let educators off the hook because there are some economic disadvantages.
I can make one last comment. I promise this is the last comment. You are letting educators off the hook if you allow them to continue to use social constructs such as race to define children. So, I understand what you're saying, but you are still allowing them off the hook because, unfortunately, you have a lot of people who are not teachers by vocation. They're mm-hmm. teachers because the opportunity was there. And it is very easy for people like that to dismiss children, especially young black males, as someone who's trouble, put them on a track of a low achiever, and the child is stuck there, whereas a teacher who actually has a vocation might have helped that child. So you're still letting them off the hook if you focus on the social construct and never try to go any deeper into what prevents children, regardless of race, and that is a sense of a social construct, which prevents them from learning to read and achieve.
Thank you. Yes. One last comment about the caller. I wish we mm-hmm. could dismiss the social construct of race, but when you look at the quality of life indicators, employment, incarceration rates, education attainment, earned income, and life expectancy, there are racial variables that still come into play. So just by ignoring it, or by virtue of ignoring it, doesn't mean that we are somehow freeing educators to think about the individual child. And many adolescents do accept themselves as racial beings, so by us dismissing that, that can be another barrier that's created, because identity is a central part of who we are.
Well, let me ask you right out. I mean, do you think that part of the problem here with part of the reason that young black boys, teenage black boys are not doing better does have something to do with the fact that there are some, maybe many, teachers who don't expect them to do well, and the kids know that?
I think that's a major part of that, and even in the light of high expectations without quality instruction is insufficient. So many teachers, not just white teachers, but African-American teachers, give a lot of pep talks, P-E-P, but they give very few prep talks, P-R-E-P. So I can't, but many African-American males already accept the premise that reading is powerful and has a wide range of possibilities, but they're never able to experience that. So we're trying to convince them or motivate them that reading is important, but they need to learn how to read with ease. And again, that's the difference between providing pep talks and providing prep talks.
Yeah. Well, let's take some other calls here. We have a number of people here. Next, yes. Back here locally in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just have one question, and that is, I know that at least in Florida, the State Department of Education made a lot of claims about improvement among blacks and Hispanics. And when, for example, the Orlando Sentinel looked into it, they found that what was really going on is that they were shifting minorities into special education classes, and therefore their test scores were not used to calculate the standard student improvement. And I was just wondering if you could speak to what's going on in terms of that nowadays, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
I don't know exactly what's happening in Florida, but in many ways our reading achievement is being defined or explained by bar graphs and scattergrams. So we have all of these data available to us, and data are being manipulated to indicate that school districts or schools are doing better. So in many ways, reading achievement is becoming more about the statistical data than it is about becoming the students. And if you politicize it in that way, some school districts are finding ways to inflate the data, while many students are surrendering their life chances before they get to know their life choices. So we have to start taking the focus off the data and the statistical overload, and really pay attention to literacy as a form of activist to not only improve students' literacy needs, but to improve their lives. And if you do that, the focus will, I think, needs to be taken off of the data and how different districts are interpreting the data to make themselves look as if they are effectively addressing the literacy needs of all students.
Let's talk again with someone else here in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm intrigued by two phrases I heard the author make. First of all, you've been using the phrase reading as activism, mm-hmm. and that just, you know, sounds pretty good to me. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, you know, how that plays into the instruction, and you talked about preparation talks, PREP. So could you amplify on those two points?
Two things. I think as I speak to a lot of teachers and administrators, literacy has become a functional tool to improve test scores, and you are improving scores, but you, in some ways you're not having students reading better, but they're performing better on reading related tasks. So I think that's literacy as a form to literacy in that sense becomes a measure to report out on students. But when you think about literacy as a tool of activism, you put the child at the center of literacy development, and you have, in that sense, you use traditional and non-traditional ways to address their literacy needs and not necessarily focus on a program that others, researchers, and I can probably be included in that, are saying is effective. And the other point about prep talk, there's a lot of teacher talk that takes place in middle school classrooms, but teacher talk alone is not going to help a child become better at decoding tasks or self-questioning tasks or making connections across text. They need ample experiences and have that modeled and scaffolded in a way, and I think that would shift the focus. When students learn that they are able to read with ease, although they embrace the fact already that reading is important. So, again, I don't need to use these pep talks, but prepare them to do things at the word level, the sentence level, and the text level, where they can see themselves becoming better readers, becoming smarter, and developing their identities about who they are and what's possible for them.
Thank you. That clarified a lot. When I hear the word activism, though, it I think of springing, I hate to use the word, springing to action, making a change in the world, and is that part of your focus when you're teaching young black male adolescents that this is a form of activism that they can do, you know, right now?
Yeah,
change the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that I, if I had to use another phrase for that, when we plan literacy instruction to really advocate for students' lives, in that way we become activists. And it is the hope through the types of text that we expose them to that they are able to identify a thread that says, this is what I need to do to participate in a democratic society or make this democratic society better. I can become proactive in some of the things and not handicap myself or become handicapped by the instruction. And the other thing that's really, really striking to me as I enter a lot of schools, teachers are really following a script, recommended curriculums or recommended instructional practices, and the data clearly shows that we still have 8 million struggling readers in the United States. 5 out of 10 students who go to college need to take remedial courses. If you look at those long-term trajectories, then that suggests that we need to do something different inside of our classrooms, and it becomes a form of activism and not the teacher becoming a technocrat.
What kinds of texts would you recommend for these young men who are struggling to learn to read both at the middle school and the high school level?
It's a wide variety of texts. One, I think all students need to be exposed to text that's intellectually exciting, text that serves as some type of roadmap, text that provides apprenticeship, text that can fix their lives, whatever that means, turning point text or touchstone text. So what that means, we need to expose them to multiple forms of text, but we need to give them the requisite skills and strategies in order to handle those texts.
Do you, in your book, have a list of meaningful... I know that sometimes things are written, you know, for the middle school and the high school student, with the design of, you know, this is what they need at a particular age and this is how we want to socialize them and things of this sort. But what I hear you saying is that we're not reaching the young black males with whatever texts we're producing. So are there texts that you're aware of that can be used by middle and high school teachers that are more relevant and turning and discuss turning point lives, turning points in the lives of young black males?
Yes, I do recommend some of those texts. Just to give you an example, Letter to My Nephew by James Baldwin. There's another one, The Pact, Three Young Men Make a Promise and Fulfill a Dream. The Greatest by Walter Dean Myers. I know some of these may be middle school and others high school, but there are a lot of provocative speeches that are out there that can be used for African American males. I usually use excerpts from Jesse Jackson's 1984 Democratic National Convention speech. These are texts that have challenging vocabulary but provide messages, but it gives them a different type of word power as they move forward for that, and it helps them examine their own lives, and it connects to larger democratic principles. So again, there are wide varieties of texts out there, but that needs to be part of the conversation as we think about addressing the literacy needs of African Americans and not just focusing in on the skills and strategies. It has to be broadened in that sense.
As useful as that will be for young black males, I think that those things that you would have them read are equally important for young people across the board.
Absolutely, I would agree with you. There's one text that I often use, and it's not specifically culturally responsive to African American males. It's the Declaration of Independence. That is a provocative piece that challenges students to use decoding skills, but it connects to so many other concepts that need to be discussed. So, again, we have to open up what African-American males are exposed to, and not just African-American males, adolescents in general. Mm-hmm. Many of these adolescents experience what I refer to as an in-school text underload.
What does that mean?
They don't have the types of text they're exposed to is very limited by some of the curriculum choices that are made, and if you're missing the mark, we're not selecting text that helps them to understand the variables and factors that are affecting their lives inside of school. There's a distance or a gap between the two. So I, as a classroom teacher, as a researcher, continue to try to select text that creates a balance between what happens inside of schools and outside of schools, so the school become real in many ways.
Thank you very much.
All right. We are talking this morning in this second hour of Focus 580 with our guest. He is Dr. Alfred Tatum. He is assistant professor in the Department of Literacy Education at Northern Illinois University. And in his academic work, he's particularly interested in adolescent literacy and literacy development of African-American males. And he's written a book on this. It's a book that's aimed primarily at educators, but anyone interested in this issue, I'm sure, could benefit by looking at it. His book is titled Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males, Closing the Achievement Gap. It's published by Stenhouse Publishers, based in Portland, Maine. He will be giving a talk on this subject this coming weekend, that Saturday, November 5th, at the Urbana Free Library from 10 to noon, sponsored by the Illini Reading Council, Champaign-Ford Office, Regional Office of Education, the Champaign and Urbana Schools, the U of I College of Education, and the Urbana Free Library. People who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana who are interested in attending, I think, should feel welcome. And then, as I say, you can certainly seek out the book if you want to read up on the subject. We have another caller here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Normal on our line 4, toll free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Alfred.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. This has been very informative so far, but I have a question for you.
Yes.
I've been volunteering my services for K-12 education for the past 14 years. Here in Central Illinois. And I can appreciate this gap that you're talking about. I've watched it with some of the programs I've been involved in. But if you have, to me, before the issue of racial gaps, we've got a gender gap where two-thirds of the honor roll students at any of our public schools in Central Illinois are women.
Mm-hmm.
How could this be? Isn't this considered a gap?
You know, absolutely. In the past 10 years or so, there's been more attention given to the gender gap and how we need to examine that more closely. And that, again, as we think about some of the distance between who's generally teaching and who's generally being taught, what type of orientations are being taken, schools in many ways can become very suitable for young African American. Women, because of the kinship that a lot of them have with the female teachers. So that plays into it as well. And that begs the question, we need to look at the types of text that boys respond to as opposed to the types of text that girls respond to. And there was an interesting book that came out with Jeffrey Wilhelm and Michael Smith that defined some of the characteristics of text that boys generally prefer, the nonfiction, the text that they can export into real-life conversations, the text with male archetype characters. So if that's not taking place, then we need to find a way to rectify those issues.
Well, how do you do that without getting to the actual attitudes of the teachers? Because what I've found, against all hope, mm-hmm. is that most of the female teachers are completely aware that they are discriminating against their male students.
You said they are aware or unaware?
They are aware of it.
Well, again, that's part of the professional development or the conversation that needs to take place. If we are aware of it and we're not doing something about it, then that makes it really problematic. And that's why I say literacy, really literacy has to be a form of activism. We have to find a way to advocate for young men in classrooms if they are experiencing this literacy gap. The same would be true if young women were experiencing the literacy gap. We would have to find a way to advocate for them and take we would have to take a different assessment close up to see what we need to do to move beyond that particular gap.
Well, it seems to me we've already got the techniques. I mean, we've been employing them in pursuit of diversity.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that while we've been pursuing diversity and really have been coming down hard emphasizing racial diversity,
mm-hmm.
what we've missed is the fact that the same discriminatory attitudes are being allowed to sit in other areas where they aren't as easily noticed,
mm-hmm.
but they're just as lethal. And
yep.
in the end, this is coming right back around to racial discrimination, which they think they're eliminating, but you can't if you're going to be gender discriminating.
Yeah, and in that discrimination, it may be inadvertent. I don't believe it's malicious, and I think most teachers are well-meaning. And although we do have the techniques and the research that has existed for the past 25 years and more, we don't have the practice. So the techniques without the practice gives us the same results in many ways. And I think school leadership has to begin to, as I'm calling for teachers to advocate for students, the administrators have to advocate for the teachers. Many teachers would say they are handicapped to deal with these particular issues. Some of that may be true and some of it may be untrue. But, I mean, that begs a larger question that needs to be addressed.
Well, the poll that I've taken, the informal poll that I've taken here in central Illinois,
yes,
finds that the teachers at K through 12 level, particularly junior high or middle school and high school, that these ladies are well aware of. As a matter of fact, one math teacher, when I asked the question of was she aware that this was happening, she said yes. And I said, well, what do you think the reason is behind it? And she looked at me and she said, payback.
Oh, from years of oppressing women?
Yes.
Oh, I mean that's personal. I mean, I don't know if
that's personal, but that was echoed by deans at high schools in the area that I've been able to engage in, you know, very private conversations and have a talk about this stuff, where they knew that that I only had the interests of the kids at heart. Mm-hmm. What I was trying to do was develop programs like you're talking about. From an outsider perspective, I'm a parent perspective, and the teachers are aware of the discrimination in the same way that whites were aware that they were discriminating against blacks.
For years. And
I've
been in some schools, quite a few actually, where there's been a corrosive culture. But until we started having this honest type of dialogue and moving toward practices where they saw noticeable changes in students' literacy behaviors and teaching practices, were we able to move beyond some of those, some of that corrosive culture. So, I mean, it has to be a critical part of the conversation and dialogue. And, you know, what you're doing is absolutely necessary. And I don't think one teacher can ruin the entire culture. If she's unique in that particular item, then that's okay. But if it's a school-wide culture, then, again, that begs the question for leadership and examining curriculum orientations, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, let me appreciate the comments of the caller, and I want to get some other people in here. We're getting into about our last 10, 15 minutes. But it seems that I find myself going back to earlier in the conversation, we talked a little bit about, and I noted that in the book that you talk about major barriers that stand in the way of closing the gap. And one of them essentially is a lack of clear definition of what the purpose is. And one might say the purpose of literacy education broadly, but specifically since we're talking about black adolescent males, what the purpose of literacy education for them is. And it seems that there is this kind of debate going on between what it's all about and what the curriculum should be all about. And is it, on the one hand, And we certainly know that there's increasing pressure to demonstrate student performances. On the one hand, about getting them to pass the tests, or is it about what the rest of their life is going to be? So the debate is, should the curriculum be functional or should it be empowering? And I'm sure that you would make the argument that it could be both. But is there indeed within the educational community and within people who teach reading, is there a debate going on about what really the purpose of the whole thing is and whether indeed it can and should be empowering, or it's more just about teaching skills and about getting kids to perform well on tests?
I think there's a inner debate going on among teachers. Oftentimes when I ask teachers this particular question, what is the role of literacy instruction, they have multiple definitions. It's about a democratic society. It's about empowering students. It's about allowing students to make choices to improve their lives. But at the same time, there's a national momentum influenced by accountability standards that sort of obfuscate some of those focuses. So you have a role of literacy theoretically or internally, but it doesn't come out in this particular practice because teachers want to be, because they're held accountable and they have to increase these test scores. So what you often have is a pendulum that swings both ways. Some teachers are able to find a balance between providing literacy that's functional. I mean, kids have to be able to read words in front of them. We can't ignore that. But beyond being able to read words and text in front of you, what does literacy mean? They're not examining the part of the pendulum that swings towards promise and possibilities. So again, it's an internal dialogue that's going on, but it's one that's not quite often practiced because there are some factors that teachers feel as if they're handicapped by.
I find myself thinking about, is there some kind of danger or concern that what you're going to do is by looking at a particular kind of curriculum for these students and something that you think will speak to their experience, that you're going to get arguments about essentially a fracturing of the curriculum so that you end up identifying a number of different groups of students saying, well, here's a curriculum for this group and here's a curriculum for this group. And I'm thinking about the earlier caller who said, well, wouldn't it be good that all students read certain sorts of things? And we would all agree that was true. I mean, do we end up having to have a specialized curriculum for every kind of student?
Oh, absolutely not. I think African Americans are part of the American experience, as are all the students coming for there. So there's some text that we need to read to really understand the American experience. But at the same time, each group brings in some schema, some background that says, how am I identified or reflected in this types of text, and what does this really mean for me? So what we have to do is not limit the types of text that we expose them to. We have to expand it. I've known African-American males who were inspired by the reading of Shakespeare. I wouldn't say that was culturally responsive, but how it was taught, they found a thread that connected to their human identity. So although you have this, what you use as fracturing, you have this African-American identity or this Asian-American identity, we also have to pay attention to students' human identity. So we have to open up the curriculum in more robust ways and not limit it. But if students aren't responding to the types of text that we are exposing them to and there's resistance, we have to know that there are other possibilities that we need to be considered. And all of this will be informed by an ongoing assessment. By virtue of pulling text in that may appear to be culturally responsible, culturally relevant, that may not be the thing that ignites a student's focus on developing his literacy needs or pay attention to his multiple literacy needs. So we have to expose them to more, not less. But at the same time, we can honor the uniqueness that every child brings to the classroom.
We have some other callers here. I want to try to get at least a couple of them in. And I'm, one of them apparently is a teacher. So I wanted to particularly get, she's on our lunch break. So we want to get her a caller in Paxton, line number 4.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I just was listening, and I just wanted to address the comments made about the corrosive culture and the directed toward males in the classroom. I've taught first grade for 27 years, and I just haven't ever seen any evidence of any discrimination on part of the teachers toward the boys in the classroom. I do want to say I think something needs to be done to make a concerted effort to get more males in the classroom, especially at the elementary level. We have about 400 children in our elementary building, and besides, I mean, we have no males except the principal and the custodian. And I've had, I think I've had 11 student teachers from the University of Illinois so far. They've all been excellent, but only one male, and he was horrendously popular in the building. The boys just latched onto him so deliberately. And so I would just like to have the guest comment on ways that they think that we could make a concerted effort to get more men involved in the educational process of these children.
Yeah, good point.
Well, it's one that I'm losing sleep over, and I think, you know, there is an absolute need to have more males in the teaching force, but with the only caution that we need to have males who can provide quality literacy instruction. Not by virtue of being a male doesn't mean that they, you know, can provide that quality literacy instruction. But again, these young men do want to identify with someone who looks like them in many ways, but that's a major challenge, and I think colleges of education really have to make a concerted effort to recruit more males and more minority, educators of color. It's just a challenge that we really haven't taken on full steam ahead.
Yes, that's very true. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Effingham for our next caller. This is line number 2. Hello.
Yes, I'm a retired history teacher, 8th grade level. About 39 years experience, but 35 in Effingham, which is my hometown, and admittedly not too many minorities.
Mm-hmm.
But I found as a history teacher that the boys dominated the classroom in terms of interest and dialogue and conversation. And I tried to bring in all aspects of our history, mm-hmm. not just George Washington, but the role that all minorities played in it. And I found that boys were quite active in our school of about 850 kids. They certainly were not neglected. I've always wondered about this because I found this true in my high school days in Springfield. And, of course, admittedly, in both the faculty there and in Effingham, there were a fair amount of fellows. I mean, we're not just an all-female group here, but I thoroughly enjoyed my male students and found them most direct in dialogue and conversation. So thank you very much for listening.
All right.
Okay. I think, first of all, that the teacher needs to take some credit for, you know, actively engaging the students. They weren't, you know, actively engaged outside of, you know, this particular teacher. So first she needs to examine what she was doing. And the other thing, it can be something about nonfiction text that the young men were paying attention to. And then the last thing that I'm always cautious about, I've been in quite a few classes where the males were dominant in discussion and conversation, had some very, very powerful insights, but they still had difficulty handling text independently. That may not be the case with the caller students, but we need to make sure that although they can contribute these wonderful ideas, become actively engaged, they can handle text and have the skills that are transferable beyond our classrooms, which is something that we really need to pay attention to. Because kids struggle with reading does not mean that they somehow lack intelligence or the ability to engage in rich and meaningful dialogue, but we want to make sure that they are prepared again to handle text independently when they resign themselves to a quiet moment or, again, move beyond our high school classrooms.
Hmm. We're almost out of time. We want to real quick maybe get a final comment here from Urbana caller on our line number 1. Hello.
Good morning again.
Good morning.
I was quite annoyed with the gentleman who is a volunteer in the school system claiming that the young women seem to dominate the honor roll. And since he did not have any hard statistics but just just anecdotal information, I will mention 2 years ago I went to a high school graduation from the Champaign High School, and I noticed that there were no women on the stage who were making statements about what school meant to them. And when I looked at the, and they were all white males, and when I looked at the listing of people on the honor roll, I saw the names of many women. I saw many Asian names. I saw Latina names. And so the I really don't worry too much about the white male and how they do in school, because from this one non-research experience, I saw that men were still very much those who were making the public comments and who were sitting on stage. Not all the honor roll people were sitting on stage, just a few who were invited to make speeches. So I'm pretty appalled at the gentleman who thought that women teachers were paying back the male students by not teaching them as well. So thanks for letting me air that that point of view.
All right. Well, we'll give you the opportunity to make any kind of final comments that you would like to, Dr. Tatum.
Yeah, I just want to share lastly that literacy instruction is really about students' life outcome trajectories, all students, and we need to provide them with ample text that allows them to examine who they are and what they want to become, because we need fewer students surrendering their life chances before they know their life choices. And educators play a significant role in this. And we have to honor the complexity of literacy instruction and not reduce it to a set of skills and strategies. And I think the conversation will continue.
All right. Well, our guest, Alfred Tatum, will be giving a talk on this very subject, the subject of his book, Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males, coming up this weekend, Saturday, November 5th, at the Urbana Free Library, co-sponsored by the Illini Reading Council and the Champaign-Urbana Schools, the Regional Superintendent of Education, the U of I College of Education, the Urbana Free Library, and anybody should feel welcome to attend. Our guest, Alfred Tatum, he is an assistant professor in the Department of Literacy Education at Northern Illinois University. And Professor Tatum, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for the show comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from the Great Impasta, restaurant serving foods from Northern Italy. The Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour, we will join National Public Radio for a news special about President Bush's nomination of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. We will move the Capitol Steps Politics Takes a Holiday Halloween special to 3:30 this afternoon. It will be repeated at 6:30 this evening. We'll air the first half of The World.